When I was in seminary in Pittsburgh, I had a friend who was, his name was Magnus Moseray. And Magnus was a missionary to the United States from Sierra Leone. He was kind of a self-appointed missionary, but he was great. And he wound up in seminary, and he and I were classmates and friends. And one day, Magnus, he was doing an internship at a pretty large church in an inner city context, East Liberty Presbyterian, and they had this homeless ministry. And for Easter, the Easter dinner, I think it was on like Good Friday or Saturday or something, they invited the guys for a meal, and there's a worship service first. So Magnus is telling the story in a debriefing group for interns, and Magnus says, "There were four people, there were four homeless men, and I looked at them and I said, I preach to you like you are 400, and all four got saved." So I was like, wow, I mean, that's really impressive, Magnus. So I'm going to preach to you like you're 400 now. Just kidding. It's a sort of an intimate day today. So if you're visiting us, which would be Glenn, we're spending some time this fall in the book of Genesis, specifically in the story of Joseph. One of the things that's really interesting, I think, about the way we greet one another in culture is, like, when you're at a party and you want to get to know somebody, you can't just ask the direct question what you really want to know, right? Like, who are you? You know, you just don't do that. Now, in some traditional cultures, right, that are more family-oriented, you might ask somebody, well, whose are you? What family do you come from? Because your identity is rooted in sort of a clan or a family name, parental identity, tribe, something like that. In our culture, it's not, we don't ask that generally, unless you're from a super small town. We ask, what do you do? Which can be a really painful question if you don't like your job, or if you're unemployed, or if you feel like the way you earn your money, your occupation, doesn't line up with your vocation, who you're really called to be, or you don't want to, you know, it's a strange question, because when we ask that, it's sort of reductive. Those questions are always kind of reductive, right? And they tell us a lot about the culture and we live in. But I think that, like, one of the things that sometimes I've asked people is, and I rarely do it because I'm usually not this thoughtful at parties, but once in a while, I'll ask people a question that's different, which is, what's your story? Because I think that's a question that actually gets closer to who we really are, and you have to ask in the right context because people think you're like flaky or something if you ask that at the wrong party. But I think it's an invitation, and I think it's a great question for self-reflection. There's a philosopher, Alistair MacIntyre, who was a moral philosopher, big in the second half of the 20th century. And he says this, before I ask, what must I do, I must first ask, of what story am I a part? And he was really reacting to this tendency in college classrooms to teach ethics like it's moral calculus. Okay, here's a bomb, here's the people, what do you do? He's like, you can't just teach ethics that way. If you're going to ask, what should I do, you have to ask, what's your story? Who do I want to be? What are the things that inform my views of fidelity, loyalty, courage? And ultimately, I think that that's the question we all have to ask ourselves all the time. And it's why I think Genesis is such a great part of Scripture to study and reflect on, because these are really earthy stories. And they're stories where we can see the breadth and depth of the human condition, and we can see how God is working blessings and is exercising care in some of the most dysfunctional, really, really challenging family situations that look a lot like the families, the relationships, the workplaces that most of us live in. So I think it's a pretty practical thing to study. And so that being said, let's pray and we'll look at the particularities of this story. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. You, O Lord, who are our rock and redeemer. Amen. This is our second week in this story, and there's three things I think I want to highlight from this text. It's a little bit of a longer text, but there are three things I think that jump out that if we see them and reflect on them, we get the gist of it. It begins with a plan, right? There's this Joseph's father Jacob sends him to go check on his brothers, then it puts Joseph on this path, which is really interesting, that some of the details and winding ways this thing unfolds. And lastly, we see Joseph tragically ending up in this pit. So start with a plan. Just by way of recap, if you're not super familiar with the Joseph story, Joseph's father, Jacob, is a guy who, this story is sort of riddled with family favoritism, and it makes a lot of sense because Jacob was deeply wounded by family favoritism. And what happens, because his father doesn't give him the kind of affirmation and acceptance he's yearning for, his older brother gets it all, he leaves home, and yet, like, with this strange sense of spiritual destiny and yet this strange sense of neediness and brokenness. And like what happens when we're all needy and broken, like we kind of fixate on something usually that we think will make it go away. So for Jacob, it's Rachel. He meets this woman and he's just head over heels in love. And all of us can relate to this, right? Like whether it's head over heels in love with this person or whether it's being head over heels in love with a job opportunity or with a group of friends or some kind of thing, anything in creation that we try to sort of use to fill a void only the Creator can fill becomes what the Bible calls an idol. And so on some level, there's probably some identity work that Jacob needs to wrestle through that he actually winds up probably doing some of it through this love of his life. And because she probably is filling some needs that probably aren't the healthiest thing in the world, it spills out into the rest of the family. And so what we wind up with is the sort of favoritism and real, like, fraternal strife that you can see really characterizes the beginning of this story. So we come to this part here at verse 12, and you're almost thinking, what are you thinking, Jacob? Like, you've got this son who's kind of, in the previous story we looked at last week, kind of looks a little bit like a spoiled brat, and who can blame him? Right, when you're told you're the favorite kid, when you're given this royal coat of many colors, when you're sort of, it's almost like his dad gives him a tuxedo to go out and, you know, go put this tuxedo on and go, you know, tend the flock with your brothers, right? It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. So I'm going to send you, the one who last week we saw, tells bad reports, sort of gossips, and maybe is a little deceptive even about his brothers and their performance. I'm going to send him by himself to go check on them with this royal coat, which reminds them, of course, that he's my favorite and that I've been a pretty dysfunctional dad. And he'll probably be a great foreman, the youngest son for the elder brothers. Great plan, right? Wonderful plan. But it's like one of those things where hindsight is 20/20. I think, like, when you read the text and you read it, like, with fresh eyes, you're like, this is kind of absurd, right? But how many times in our lives do we think the plans we make, which other people can see are absurd, and maybe later in life we think are absurd, and yet in the middle of it, it looks like it makes perfect sense. But I think this is like when our idols kind of take over our life, we get kind of blinded. And I've been told this is true. I've never experienced it because I'm not a pilot, but I'm told that early pilots in training, they when they fly into a cloud cover, they don't trust their instruments generally, young pilots. They just don't, so they're always tweaking because they're nervous because of the cloud cover. And there's pilots that have come out of deep cloud covers flying upside down, and they didn't know it. Because in the midst of the cloud cover, they're disoriented, tweaking, and by the time the light comes on, they're completely turned over and haven't realized it. And I think the way, like, idols and sin in our lives and in families and relationships work are very often like that. So, yeah, this seems totally crazy on one level, right? But all of us have moments where we pursue crazy, crazy plans or relate in crazy, broken, seemingly insane ways, and yet at the moment, it makes sense. And the moment when we think our needs are being met in ways that probably aren't the best, when we get off kilter, when we stop trusting the instruments that God gives us, the ways that he reveals himself, that, hey, if you want to live a whole life that's marked by love and wholeness, then there are certain rules to the road. There are certain parameters that'll keep you on that path. When we don't trust the instruments, we are often like Jacob here, doing something that is seemingly pretty crazy. But in the moment, I think the plan to him must make sense. And so this plan winds up sending Joseph on this path. One of the things that you notice about the Joseph story, it's like one of the longest narrative chunks in Genesis. The stories are super detailed and super offer almost like mundane kinds of details. It's not like reading like ancient poems like Homer, right, or something where there's not a lot of gritty details. There's a lot of gritty details in the story. There are a lot of repetition. In fact, I was watching this PBS special on Genesis. It sounds super exciting, right? PBS special on Genesis, but it was actually really great. And one of the rabbis, who it was Christians, Jews, Muslims, secularists, all talking about Genesis. And Bill Moyers asked the rabbi, do you like this story? He's like, no, I was telling somebody, I can't stand it. It's so boring and plotty and all the repetition. But he says, you know, one of the things I think that it reminds us is that our lives often seem plotty and over-detailed and mundane and boring and not exciting, and that this is where God works. That God works in the ordinariness of life. It's one of the reasons I think that there's all these details. And yeah, I think that the details and the way the path unfolds paint a story that, while it's super detailed, all these things have to click, right? Jacob has to send him to find his brothers. When his brothers aren't at Shechem, where they think, it's really interesting, right? Joseph, the text says, is wandering around. And then there's this guy that just says, they're at Dothan. Now, in the ancient Near East, right, generally probably people aren't just walking around wilderness areas by themselves. In fact, some, if you look at the history interpretation of this text, some people actually think that it's an angel. I think that probably goes beyond what the text is saying, but it's strange, to say the least, that this man, this stranger, is there just at the time to point Joseph to Dothan. I think that, like, on one level, like, one of the things that philosophers and some theologians do is they debate things like terms like providence and free will and predestination and determinism, indeterminism, is this kind of free will, this kind of... I think that stuff's academically interesting, like, and I've spent some time in nerdy contexts having detailed discussions like that. But I think at the end of the day, practically, there's really like two kinds of people, right? There's two kinds of people. The first thing I'll say is there's M. Night Shyamalan people and non-M. Night Shyamalan people, right? So if you like M. Night Shyamalan films. But in the movie Signs, which is about this Episcopal priest who's kind of lost his faith, his wife dies in a tragic car accident. I think she's hit by a drunk driver. We wind up, there's this strange alien phenomena. And in the middle of the movie, his young kind of, his brother-in-law, who's kind of this strange character, says, tell me what you used to say. Tell me what you used to say in this really tense, suspenseful moment. He says, what do you mean? About things making sense. And he says, well, and Mel Gibson sort of goes into sermon mode. There's two kinds of people. People that think everything is left up to chance. And the kind of people that think everything has a purpose. And I think that he's right about that. Like, fundamentally, we could argue a little bit philosophically about the details, but you're either going to believe life is purposeless or purposeful. So one of the reasons I think that, like, one of the strange aspects of modernity is we know more and more about the world than ancient people did through science, through technology, but yet we feel less and less at home in it, which is the interesting thing, because science can tell us, like, what a frog's DNA is, but science can't tell us what frogs are for. When you take the purpose question out, life becomes really hard to live because we're wired to seek purpose and meaning. So I think that you either look at life as being purposeful, and somehow there's a bigger intentionality that's ordering your steps, or not. Now, there's lots of ways it doesn't mean that, like, every single bad thing has an immediate silver lining or stuff like that. But you have to believe, I think, either that there's no overarching arc and thus no hope, or that there is. And I think this text, the author of this text, is coming down firmly on the side of there's purpose. And that's why there's these winding details. That's why there's this stranger. That's why he Joseph is directed, even though it's tragic, directed on a really purposeful, ordered path. So he winds up in this path, on this path, finding his brothers eventually at Dothan. And his brothers, of course, have plans of their own. And you can see the sort of vitriol in their reaction. When they saw him, they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer." Some translations say stuff like, "Here's the dream master," right? Because of these dreams he had in the previous part of the chapter, that he was going to be this great figure, and his brothers, and even his mother and father, were going to be indebted to him, that he was going to be this ruler in some unique way. So they're like, you know what? Here he comes. He's got that coat on again. It's over. Like, let's finally resolve this. We're tired of the coat. We're tired of the favoritism. We're tired of his youthful arrogance. We're tired of the way it makes us feel. Because most broken relationships, right, there's generally a little bit of truth in the thing that wounds you. So they're just done. And they change Joseph from a subject to an object, right? He's no longer a living, breathing person that, even though he's been hurtful, has his own set of hurts, he just becomes the thing that has to be removed. Tragic, and yet, there's a purpose. There's a purpose in the carefully ordered steps. Even though I think it's hard to believe that lots of times in life, right? Especially when the path that's like leads you into a place like a pit. I don't know about you, like if when you like watch TV shows or films, they're like, I always think about like what are the worst ways to die, like in like suspense thrillers and stuff. And the thing that like terrifies me the most is buried alive, right? When somebody is buried alive in a coffin or something, running out of air, no one can hear them, pounding on the thing. To me, that's like the worst, right? The feeling of just vulnerability, the feeling of being trapped, the feeling of not having any options, the feeling of crying out and no one can hear you. Whenever a film like that, I know there are other awful ways of coming to your demise, surely, but for me personally, that's the one that, like, when I see that in a show or a film, I get really, like, I start shaking, and, you know, it's like you see yourself in the show or the film. Yeah, I can't imagine what's going through Joseph's mind in the pit. While his brothers are debating his fate, it's, what is he thinking? How could they do this? I mean, I had these dreams where my life was going to be something. And now I'm in this pit. Maybe I'll die? Was he thinking maybe I deserved it? Maybe I was a jerk? Was he thinking, how could my dad have been such a weird dad that everything got us to this place? It's one of those things where, like, one of the things that I think is so terrifying about that way of coming to your demise is not just the fact that you might die there in this dark pit, you're alone with your thoughts, and maybe like pretty terrible and dreadful thoughts, and feeling so vulnerable. And yet, the pit is part of the deep purpose that God has here. I was reading a book yesterday that I haven't looked at in a long time called Let Your Life Speak by a guy named Parker Palmer. And if you haven't read it, it's 120 pages. It's really accessible. I'd really recommend it. But it's about vocation and sort of finding your true self and how that connects to relationships and occupation. But in it, he says this, but before we come to that center full of light, we must travel in the dark. Darkness is not the whole of the story. Every pilgrimage has passages of loveliness and joy. But it is the part of the story most often left untold. When we finally escape the darkness and stumble into the light, it is tempting to tell others that our hope never flagged, to deny those long nights we spent cowering in fear. He goes on to say, the experience of darkness has been essential to my coming into selfhood, and telling the truth about the fact helps me stay in the light. But I want to tell the truth for another reason as well. Many young people today journey in the dark, as the young always have, and we elders do them a disservice when we withhold the shadowy parts of our lives. When I was young, there were very few elders willing to talk about the darkness. Most of them pretend that success was all they had ever known. As the darkness began to descend on me in my early 20s, I thought I had developed a unique and terminal case of failure. I did not realize that I had merely embarked on a journey toward joining the human race. In the rest of that chapter, Palmer talks a lot about just the nature of failure and how his own failures actually helped him discover who he really was and what he was actually uniquely suited to be in the world. I think, like, when we're in the pit, it can seem like there's not purpose. And it's a hard truth, and it's a truth that's, like, not an easy one to digest. But if we really believe there's purpose, then there has to, that purposefulness doesn't stop in the pits of our lives. When we feel vulnerable, when we feel like things are closing in and there's no way out. What's really interesting is, this happens to Joseph at a place called Dothan. There's another place in 2 Kings 6 where the prophet Elisha and his servant are hemmed in by the Syrian army, and Elisha's servant says, "Geez, I don't know what we're going to do. We're at an end here. What's going to happen?" Elisha assures him that God's there, and they open their eyes and they see chariots of fire in the heavens, and they're delivered. They call out at the same exact place centuries later. They call out to God, and they get chariots of fire. Joseph, I'm sure, is crying out. And what does he get? Silence. Same God. Same place. Two different forms of deliverance. What Elisha needs is a more simple salvation. Elisha and his compatriot, they needed a pretty simple salvation. Joseph needed a pretty complex salvation. Because, see, Joseph, and for those of you who are familiar with the story, and this is one of those stories that even if we're not super familiar with the Bible and the Old Testament, this is the kind of thing they make cartoons and musicals of. So some of us have seen the Technicolor Dreamcoat or something. Joseph winds up being the family member that would actually become, through the pit, influential in Egypt and actually save his family and his people. But first, before he could be the rescuer, he needed rescuing. Before he could be redemptive, he needed his own redeeming. Before he could be the family's hope, there had to be some healing from the favoritism and brokenness in the family system. And that's what God does in this strange and tragic story. It still is a part of the purpose and the plan, the pit. There's a rabbinic midrash, like sort of a story about the story that takes the form of a commentary, that at the end of his life, when Joseph's returning to the land of his father to bury his father's bones, that he takes the path by Dothan and sees the pit. And when he sees the pit, he blesses it and thanks God for it. Because without the pit, his life would never have been what it was. I don't know I don't know if that really happened, but there couldn't be anything truer. In this Genesis special that I was watching, one of the Islamic scholars said that in the Islamic tradition with Joseph, and it's a very different tradition, and in many ways takes the story a very different route, but he says that in the Islamic tradition, Joseph is revered as the one who helped make Egypt come to the true faith, that because he was a prophet and softened their hearts and made them receptive to the prophet who would come. And the scholar said there are places all over Egypt where there are signs and statues that this is the land to which God sent Joseph. What a beautiful sentiment. See, Joseph, though, had to involuntarily go into the pit because of the family favoritism and the brokenness so that he could be redeemed and play a redemptive role. But we have such a greater resource because of the story Joseph's a part of. Because Joseph would preserve the line that would give us the true Joseph. Jesus, who went to the pit, went to the place of death and darkness, not involuntarily, but voluntarily, who didn't need redemption and healing, who actually came out of a superabundance of good identity work, who eternally knew who and whose he was. And he laid aside the cloak voluntarily. He didn't have to have it ripped off of him. Why? So that when we're in the pit, we can be delivered from the thing which I think kills us in the pit. Maybe I deserve this. I mean, I think that's the sneaking fear behind every form of rejection, between every pit in our lives, is that maybe I had this coming. Maybe the universe is against me. Maybe the verdict on me is guilty. But the verdict fell on him. And when he cried out in the pit, the God who was listening was silent, so that by his sacrifice, we could all know the verdict for us is not guilty, that there's no pit we can't be redeemed from, that there's no place that, although the path might be hard and dreadful, that there's no place that can't be part of the redeeming, redemptive, reconciling story of God's love. When we're united to Christ in faith, it's like the sign reads above our head, this is the land to which God sent Joseph. This is the place God sent the true Joseph, that even in your worst moments, that you're the one for whom he jumped into the pit voluntarily. And when you know that, when you know that that's written across your forehead, this is the one, this is the story that God sent the true Joseph into, then you can look at the pits, even when it is tough and begrudging, but with real, albeit sometimes complex joy, bless the pits and thank God for them, because they can be part of the wonderful redemption that is his coming kingdom. Amen.